Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day, it will brighten all our way if we keep on the sunny side of life.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the TXF Export Finance Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Sheriff of XR Group. The topic for today's discussion is mandates, and specifically where it is that the ECA mandate these days starts and finishes in a world where ECAs, since the financial crisis and certainly since COVID, have been asked to step in more ways, whereas what was ultimately a developing market product is now increasingly seen, and certainly in our data seen, as a developed market product. And what used to be export finance is now actually export and import finance, or just domestic finance. ECAs have been used to pioneer funding in the green revolution and many other areas that are seen as strategically important to governments. So the challenge now comes as to how, with that in mind, you can keep a rules-based approach, and also where the ECAs stop and other institutions such as development banks or other government departments start. And that's really the center of today's discussion. I'm delighted to have with us Rebecca Harding of Rebeccanomics, Gabriel Buck of GKB Ventures, and Chris Mittman of Acre Capital and Investec. Hope you enjoy the discussion. Thanks.
I like to look for examples of things which are going well and things I think we can all aspire to, like a good mentor. I look at BPI France and its leadership, both on the modernization, their chief executive there has been vocal from the outset about radical reform being required of the OECD rules. They've also got, if you look at the number of clients that BPI France have, I mean, it's thousands and thousands of clients. It's an ambidextrous organization which can do a lot of different things. Financing which, say, by comparison, UK export finance just can't and isn't set up to do. I'm not saying one's right, one's wrong. I'm just saying if you want to be relevant and have the most impact, you know, I think a whole of government approach to supporting trade, and this is something you can do at a national level. It doesn't require the OECD to rewrite and finally sign off on a new set of rules. You've got to look at the tools in your toolbox and say, could these operate more effectively together? The various government departments, entities which are government owned in the UK context, CDC, UK Export Finance, the aid budget, all of these things are in there. British Business Bank. I mean, does it make sense for them to all be sitting there separately working on incredibly narrow mandates and trying to dance an impossible dance to stay within those? Or is something more radical and fundamental achievable by putting them all together in a big bucket, stirring it up and seeing what comes out? Because I feel that that's the sort of thing which could make a real difference.
Taking that though, because obviously if it's a bigger bucket and it's a sort of a wider mandate, then presumably export finance and export credit agency specifically is a redundant phrase.
Well, it depends. Exports and imports, it depends which side of the you're standing on. You could look at it both ways. Some agencies are highly active supporting domestic infrastructure, as well as supporting exports and as well as supporting imports of raw materials, like in Japan. So the mandates are, as I said, mandates are such an artificial construct. And, you know, looking at the way a lot of these organizations work, it's really important to have a mandate, because when you give something a budget to operate within, you've got to know what it's doing. Of course, you've got to know what it's doing. You can't just wake up one day and say, I know, I'm going to do something completely different. I have to have a work within the mandate. But yeah, I think that you could call them trade development agencies. You can call them anything you like. I mean, I think export credit agency, it always does start with an exporter looking to export something, and they tend to drive the whole process, and they fly people into Angola or whatever and spend years developing relationships and finding deals and pushing them across the line. And then everything else, us banks and ECAs, they tend to just follow in the end and the deal gets done. But so to some extent, the word export credit and export finance is very real, because the primary developer and driver of all these deals remains the exporter. Yes, there's some pull activity from national governments and national development plans announcing projects and driving those. And certainly the private sector, where you've got private sponsors, the pull is from their side. But largely it's the exporter who drives the process and brings the export finance in. But yes, the name is also, it's not a mandate constraint, but it's almost a definitional constraint, which I think shouldn't be there.
Gabby, is that the same for you? Is export credit agency an outdated phrase?
Well, I was laughing to myself when Chris was talking about or using BPI as the example of how transformational they have been. Many moons ago, and it feels like 7 or 8 years ago, I was a commissioner on the Coal Review, which was, you know, a set up here in the UK to give an independent viewpoint to UK government in terms of what it should be doing. And it came up with a whole list of things. Yeah. The person who came over to speak to me and go through it in detail was Nicholas Dufort from BPI. And within 3 months, he was instigating, because the recommendations that we were, he was instigating all the recommendations, because the recommendations we had for the UK government applied exactly the same to the French. They did. The UK government took about 7 or 8 years to start doing one or two of those things. And the big one that they did was amalgamating the equivalent of Department of Trade and Industry, UK Export Finance, the British Business Bank, the support for SMEs, making sure it was a regional or French organization. It did the whole lot. The only thing it didn't do was cover the aid budget out of France, but everything else was under BPI. So, Chris is dead right. You know, why do you have here in the UK so many different departments that overlap? It's not just the fact that it's uneconomical. It's just really confusing. If you're an exporter and you want to export to Vietnam for the first time ever, then there's a whole array of different people, you know, UK government agencies that you can go to. And the mere fact that there are so many and there isn't really one centre of excellence, I think makes us inefficient. So I think there's a lot more that governments can be doing themselves.
A huge leadership opportunity. And it's about getting, we don't need administrators. This is not a comment on any of the current management, to be clear. What you need, visionary leadership, right now, someone to take that on, and for the politicians to realize it. Otherwise, we'll just be messing around. So I looked at BPI, I think it's an amazing example. But you're drilling down that a bit more. Most of what we do at Investec and the focus of Acre Capital is Africa. And if you look at a mandate, irony is that when Acre Capital has been raising finance for infrastructure in Africa, and they're talking to all of these entities I've mentioned, not just impact investors, but ECAs, multilateral development banks, the number of entities whose mandate preclude them from doing anything except private sector lending is breathtaking. It's like, we've got this vision that the private sector should do everything. This is my narrative as to what they were thinking about when they wrote the mandate. But the reality in Africa is over 95% plus of all infrastructure goes on or around the sovereign balance sheet. So because of your principled mandate about only doing private sector, which, by the way, even in Europe, the government's still responsible for a very large proportion, the majority, I'd argue, of essential infrastructure funding, is madness. So you're not going to do something the country badly needs a hospital, but you won't do it because it can't be privately financed, because they don't have a national health system or a private sector middle class who can afford to pay for it. So they just go without them. So it's I'm just throwing an example out there as to the imperfection that mandates can cause. And also development banks say, we just do development impact. We're all about impact on the ground. Well, you are, but you won't do sovereign deals. Mm. You'll just do private sector ones. And then you've got the ECA saying, we just do exports because it's called export finance. And we say, but that hospital you just financed is incredibly impactful and developmental. So why don't you call it development finance? Well, we can't do that because we don't do development finance. This is quite recent, and the agonizing goes on. I find it quite fantastic, to be honest, because you've got to call it what it is as opposed to what the name is. Like, if it's a hospital, it's developmental impact. So yeah. I think that a lot of work can be done at national levels, and it's an opportunity for every government to work out how their various levers they have can be used to effectively promote their national trade relationships and interests. And that's within their control. It's not something that they have to wait for someone else to tell them what to do. And it's a big opportunity right now. They do it right, like BPI has, it'll turn into success and jobs and all those good things.
On the BPI example, I mean, obviously you've still got sort of aid and sort of things like Proparco, et cetera, which is still separate and out of BPI. So it's not like it's covering everything. I understand as well that sort of quite recently, the French Ministry of Finance changed their content rules on and actually tightened ratios in terms of local content in Africa. I think which is sort of driven out of a fear of probably overexposure to Africa, I think, which is quite interesting. So be interested to see how that one plays out. Rebecca, I'm quite curious. Obviously, both Gabby and Chris have sort of pushed for I'd say there's an opportunity for government, whether it's sort of supporting export, supporting trade, and also it's very much governments that are going to have to sort of foot the bill in terms of infrastructure spend in recipient countries. I'm just wondering how this mirrors some of what you're seeing now in a COVID environment. Is it, are you seeing globally government stepping up? Is it sort of the end of pure capitalism and sort of the private sector? Is it okay to say that we want big government again? Where does this fit in?
There's a huge debate on industrial policy going on, and the limits of industrial policy and the extent to which industrial policy, like the Inflation Reduction Act, like the CHIPS Act, like cross-border carbon taxation, etc., all of these types of policies are being used to achieve government objectives in one way, shape or form, and they're all influencing trade in some way. And I would say bringing everything together just under one umbrella is definitely a thing to do, but we need to find the right language. And if you look at where governments are now thinking about trade within the framework of national security strategy and economic security within those frameworks, if you look at the integrated review here, if you look at Biden's Supply Chain Act reviews, if you look at the national security strategy in the United States, they are all talking about one thing, and that's supply chain resilience. They're all talking about how that is actually part of our defence and security, not just in military terms, but also in economic terms as well. So food supply, energy supply, all of the things that we, and obviously defence and security in a military context as well. So all of these things are actually integrated together under one umbrella, which is national security strategy. And you know, if we don't have all of the organisations working together globally around what is the definition of national security and how does trade play into that, and it's actually reframing where trade sits in all of that, then I think we're in a position where we don't fully understand the power that we have to coerce, to influence, and to do good, which is what everybody wants, and restore some multilateralism through the whole trade framework. So I think there's something there that we can do that's actually quite powerful if we start looking at this in terms of supply chain resilience, because that's what concerns all of the different government departments. It's what concerns every single government across the world. I think, you know, if you want to get away from developed economy to developing and developing emerging economies, if you want to get away from that type of distinction, what are they all concerned about? What's the purpose of government? It's the allocation of scarce resources to people who can't get those scarce resources. That, you know, basic economics 101. That's the purpose of government. So all of this actually I think needs a really strong strategic lens, and it's something the World Trade Organization can look at. It's something that, you know, if only we could stop Europe and the United States arguing about the, and the UK as well, arguing about the Inflation Reduction Act, starting to do similar things and realizing that actually the Inflation Reduction Act is inflationary elsewhere because it's redistributing supply chains. If we can start looking at it like that, then I think it's not necessarily a question of big government, it's a question of appropriate government and where all of that fits into a targeted smart regulation, smart spending, industrial policy driven strategy, but one where the government knows where it can get the public and the private sector working together and around a national security agenda.
Okay, well, let's stick on that point of supply chain resilience, and specifically around, rare metals, rare earth, which is some of what you said near the beginning, Rebecca. This is an area, and it kind of then gets into sort of the grey area of mining, I suppose, which has been, for the last few years, not a particularly fashionable area of export finance, but I guess that's something that is likely to change. And Gabby, maybe you can comment on some of the trends that you're seeing and whether you think export finance is or could play more of a role in supporting sort of the green revolution through supporting mining projects and some of the complexities that might exist in doing so.
Okay, but I do want to come back to couple of points that Rebecca said. I think I think it's difficult for governments to play a role about coercing commerce, because commerce and industry and capital associated with that will take its own direction. So it's how I raise that now in terms of mining, you get a lot of countries saying that, you know, for critical minerals, they'll provide critical mineral, ECAs will provide critical mineral facilities and will say to a supplier, if you supply us with these critical minerals, we'll provide you with the financing. So it's not tied to equipment, but it is tied to the supply. And that works, I think, for some traders who have been big users of that. But, you know, all that means is that they are a trader. They're not the fundamental or not fundamental. They're not the original miner of that commodity. So government's got to be a bit wary. And I'm going back onto Chris's point, a bit wary about trying to push a private sector initiative and coerce, because commerce will just do its own thing. And I remember reading some time ago, I don't know whether this is true, but it was a Kenyan government official and was talking about how the UK government, when they come to Kenya, keep talking about PFI, PPP, and you know, and he said when the Britain comes to Kenya, we get a lecture. When the Chinese come to Kenya, we get a hospital. And so I think the directness of providing a solution now, particularly in developing markets, is what the developing markets will want to see. So put that as a backdrop. In terms of mining, I think Rebecca said 85% of lithium comes out of China. Well, 100, or it comes out, it's controlled by the Chinese. And it's 100% control of spherical grade graphite is controlled by the Chinese. And that is, you know, both of those commodities, amongst others, are crucial in terms of, you know, gigafactories and electric vehicle batteries and the manufacture thereof. And given that 50-odd% of world trade is in one way or another associated with the automotive industry, this is a big controlling interest that the Chinese have got. But if the mine is already mining and it has a long-term offtake contract with the Chinese, it's done and dusted for 25 years. But going to your question, Dan, of mining, I think there's a realization that, you know, mining is crucial for the economic development of many parts of the world. And Africa is a good example in terms of how important the extractive industry is. But it's also very crucial for the Western world in terms of, you know, literally everything that we touch and use and, on a day-to-day basis has its core base, is a metal of one form or another. Mining is what it is. You know, it's about moving earth, concentrating it, and then transporting it. And surprisingly, it's a huge capital-intensive industry. It's intensive not only in terms of setting up the mine, but in terms of the operational capex that it needs to replenish year on year. You know, and I was amazed when I looked at one mining company. It spent $500 million per annum replacing all of the yellow goods. You know, these big monster trucks have an average life of 7 years because it works in such a harsh environment 24/7. They are literally flogged to death. And so the CapEx spend is something that would be very well suited to the export credit agency market. And I have to admit, I was very surprised when I looked at your data, Dan, some time ago, how mining actually ranked quite low. You know, it was like at one point, 6th, 7th, 8th in terms of usage from a sector basis in terms of ECA. And I think there's many reasons for that. Part of which is that a lot of the mining houses are not that aware of ECA financing and have historically been very well supported by the capital markets. And I think that shift is changing. But it is a tough market to be in. I mean, it's not simple. I think it's, you know, from the environmental aspects are one that needs to be viewed at carefully. The supply chain in terms of goods and services associated with mining is relatively generic. So from a sponsor's point of view, you can play one export credit agency off against the other because you can source the equipment from a whole host of different countries. But it is, you know, it's a long term, you know, the development of a mine, getting it from its initial gestation period to first shovel in the ground could be 3, 4, 5 years, if not longer. And that I don't think suits the export credit agency bankers at this moment in time. They're looking for a much shorter gestation period to when they get involved to when they provide the financing.
I think one of the issues historically as well is actually tying up a load of these actual deals. So, you know, a lot of these yellow goods that you mentioned, particularly, you know, yes, it might be 500 or $500 million per annum, but actually some of these purchases singular are not maybe big enough in terms of a couple of trucks here or there. It's often been, you know, it's just been a bit too small for ECA a lot of the time.
If you're working on the supplier side, if you're working on the buyer sponsor side, and you said to a bank, or the sponsor can say to a bank, look, I'm going to buy $500 million worth of equipment every year. Do you want to be my banker for the next 5 years, looking at all of the ECA opportunities for all of my procurement? I'll turn to Chris. I would have thought most bankers would be very keen on that.
Well, before you turn to Chris as well, because obviously Chris is involved heavily with Acre Capital, which is obviously looking specifically at sort of an impact impact investment, impact in finance and export finance and how that interrelates. Where does some of this mining side of things, if it is for sort of, you know, electro metals or whatever, you know, where does it fit in? Is it still too complicated? Is it something that, you know, you can get sort of support outside of the traditional world of export finance for mining projects, or is that sort of off limits at the moment?
Well, so certainly from Acre's mandate, it wouldn't fit. Mm-hmm. It's climate aligned infrastructure, social infrastructure by and large for Acre. But interestingly, with my ICC hat on and sitting in all the sort of sustainability discussions, forums, gatherings, what sort of, it hasn't been a major discussion point as something in a world which is increasingly, I'm going back to my labels, this will sound like an obsession now, Dan. It's all about the label. Labels are very important.
You're all labels and hats.
Yeah, you've got to have a label for something, otherwise it doesn't exist. And I think that part of it hasn't come up as either good or bad. You know, people have said, yeah, we definitely know coal, that's bad. We won't do unabated coal. And there's just been this decision made at the OECD level. But I haven't seen such sort of a coalescence of views from ECAs or from banks as to whether mining's something which institutionally they wish to be associated with or otherwise. So InvestEd, we've done export finance, actually working with Gabby's firm some time ago for a mine in Africa around supply chains. And it worked out quite well, and we got repaid, and the mine continues to perform, and its operational performance improved as a result of using export finance. But to Gabby's point, I think that, you know, in terms of what banks do and don't, and I subscribe to the view that basically you don't tell, this is very much a bottom up, in a political environment, it's bottom up, it's not top down. Government can't, unless you're a particular government unnamed, you can't decide what industry is going to be, we're going to invest in, and what it's going to do. It's organic, it's a bottom up process. You can provide the incentives to encourage that bottom up activity, whether it's investing in green energy, providing incentives there, or securing supply chains of rare metals and others. But in the end, the initiative has to come, and the appetite has to come from the industry itself. And the same applies to banks. I just don't see sometimes banks, and that includes banks I've worked for, trying hard enough to push sometimes on the buyer end, to quote Gabby, to go and have that conversation. I travel in Africa quite a lot. Even some sovereigns, their institutional memory of export finance is quite dusty. There's someone in the corner who did a French export credit 6 years ago, but they don't really know what's, because no one visits them, because they're not potentially a scaled user of export finance. And therefore, you know, the big banks and the players who can afford to fly through don't push it, and local banks aren't involved, so the government never hears about it. And arguably, therefore, sometimes you could say maybe some projects don't happen because the market's not advocating the finance solutions which would make them happen. But it is what it is, I think. That's the problem. A lot of the players in the market are high volume players. I don't want to pivot the conversation too much, Dan, but a lot of it's to do with the individual motives for banks being in the market. If the motive is a large annuity income book of export credit guaranteed risk, they're going to go for volume, and they're going to go where they can get that volume with the least amount of expenditure required to get it onto the sheet, i.e. resources. And that's why I think there's definitely room in the market for new players to come in. And we're seeing a lot of the African banks come in now who don't need to write 4 or 5 billion a year or 10 billion a year of new ECA deals. And they can start to fill those gaps and play a meaningful role and deliver export finance to markets and borrowers who typically wouldn't catch the attention of the larger players. It's a horses for courses argument. So mining could well be one of those sectors which could benefit from the entrance of more players.
I love, Chris, and I hadn't thought about it until you've mentioned it, the issue of labels. And I realised that I've been using labels in that if I go to a bank and I said I've got a mining project, they switch off. If I go to a bank and say I've got a critical minerals project, right? And it's the labelling, because it's the same project, right? And you know, what is the definition of critical minerals? Well, you know, it's a mineral that someone really, really, really wants and it's hard to get. But that labelling, I think, is a reflection really of banks operating. Banks are our customers in one form or another, but they do operate in like a herd, and they move around in a very similar fashion. And I think they're starting to wake up. There's other business opportunities there, but it's hard for them. I feel sorry for banks. The way that they originate transactions is, you know, driven by, you know, the issues of compliance. It's much harder to onboard a customer in the developing market as a buyer than it would be to support your domestic exporter where you've got an existing relationship. You know, the cost of capture of flying halfway around the world and, you know, to investigate whether you can get a buyer mandate is significantly more time consuming than, you know, using your existing franchise. There's greater execution risk dealing with a buyer than there is with a supplier. One could argue the capital relief and rate of return is exactly the same as whether you got a supplier mandate or a buyer mandate. So why go hunting around the world when you just support suppliers, support your existing customers, support those that have already been doing export credit, you know, for the last 5 or 6 years or 10 years, which is why I think we're seeing the dominance of the volumes being in the developed market than in the developing market. Because it's driven by the behavior of the banks.
The only thing I'd add is that it's having a voice and being understood. So again, heard it be said before, but export financiers think we're world famous, but actually no one knows who the hell we are. I went to GIN in the Netherlands, in The Hague, the Global Impact Investor Network, and no one knows who the hell export financiers are or export credit agencies. So we're the world's best kept secret.
Yeah. Even under I was government. There too, Chris. We could have met up.
Oh, damn.
There's only one thing worse than being unknown in export credit, and that's being an economist who studies export credit. And then
your rarity factor, Rebecca, is
if I may, you have to humour me here. I remember years ago going to the Bank of England looking to try and get UKEF or ECGD assets at those days to get it qualified as HQLA, high quality liquid assets, in terms of being eligible to go into the liquidity buffer. And we were speaking to the Bank of England, who come up with a list of what's eligible and what's not. And they said, who's ECGD?
It's an amusing anecdote, but a serious point. The serious point is that post-JFC, the banks have been meeting under the ICC Export Credit Committee, talking about the unintended impacts on trade and export finance of regulation post-GFC and the inappropriate use of leverage. And rightly so, regulators have been challenging banks on that because some sectors were not using it appropriately. But export finance got caught up because we were unknown, relatively unknown. And the lesson that the committee took is do not be unknown. Make sure what you do is known and understood. So when Basel 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 come through, it appropriately reflects and it supports the product and its delivery. Otherwise, we will get caught up. So I think visibility is a really important point. Yeah, and as for the compliance and the increasing hurdles that we're all facing in the meantime, it should, I hope, we see firms like XFI in Zurich, I don't know if you come across them, Gabby, doing exclusively SME export finance for Swiss corporates, being funded through a cantonal bank and working with CERV, offering buyer credits for small to mid-sized enterprises. So it should spur, for those brave export financiers who are prepared to take a leap and join new organizations, there are opportunities for the market to help fill those gaps which are being created.
Thank you very much for listening to today's discussion. A huge thanks to our guests, Rebecca Harding, Rebeckonomics, Gabriel Buck of GKB Ventures, and Chris Mittman of Investec and Acre Capital. Remember, for all your export finance needs, please head along to our website, txfnews.com, where you can hear about the latest news and analysis to do with all things export finance, see our rich pool of data and deals data in particular, and find out about our events, the largest of which, the true global meeting of the export finance community, will be taking place in Lisbon this June. Very much hope to see you there. And in the meantime, see you next time. Cheers.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help.